Voice of an angel. With Mary's arm firmly guiding her, Kate reached the front of the room and waited her turn to meet the Viscountess. She seemed a lovely woman, with fair hair and light eyes, and rather petite to have mothered such large sons. The late Viscount must have been a tall man, Kate decided. Finally, they reached the front of the small crowd, and the Viscountess grasped Mary's hand.
Mrs. Sheffield, she said warmly, what a delight to see you again. I so enjoyed our meeting at the Hartside Ball last week. I am very glad you decided to accept my invitation. We would not dream of spending the evening anywhere else, Mary replied. And may I present my daughter?
She motioned to Kate, who stepped forward and bobbed a dutiful curtsy.
It is a pleasure to meet you, Miss Sheffield, Lady Bridgerton said.
And I am likewise honoured, Kate replied.
Lady Bridgerton motioned to a young lady at her side.
And this is my daughter Eloise.
Kate smiled warmly at the girl, who looked to be about the same age as Edwina. Eloise Bridgerton had the exact same colour hair as her older brother's, and her face was lit by a friendly, wide smile. Kate liked her instantly.
How do you do, Miss Bridgerton? Kate said. Is this your first season?
Eloise nodded.
I'm not officially out until next year, but my mother has been allowing me to attend functions here at Bridgerton House.
How lucky for you, Kate replied.
I should have loved to have attended a few parties last year. Everything was so new when I arrived in London this spring.
The mind boggles at the simple attempt to remember everyone's name. Eloise grinned.
Actually, my sister Daphne came out 2 years ago, and she always described everyone and everything to me in such detail. I feel as if I already recognise almost everyone.
Daphne is your eldest daughter?
Mary asked Lady Bridgerton. The Viscountess nodded. She married the Duke of Hastings last year. Mary smiled.
You must have been delighted.
Indeed. He is a duke, but more importantly, he is a good man and loves my daughter. I only hope the rest of my children make such excellent matches. Lady Bridgerton cocked her head slightly to the side and turned back to Kate.
I understand, Miss Sheffield, that your sister was not able to attend this evening.
Kate fought a groan. Clearly, Lady Bridgerton was already pairing up Antony and Edwina for a walk down the aisle.
I'm afraid she caught a chill last week.
Nothing serious, I hope, the Viscountess said to Mary, in a rather mother-to-mother sort of tone.
No, not at all, Mary replied. In fact, she is nearly back to sorts. But I thought she should have one more day of recuperation before venturing out. It would not do for her to suffer a relapse.
No, of course not.
Lady Bridgerton paused, then smiled.
Well, that is too bad. I was so looking forward to meeting her. Edwina is her name, yes?
Kate and Mary both nodded.
I've heard she is lovely.
But even as Lady Bridgerton said the words, she was glancing at her son, who was flirting madly with the Italian opera singer, and frowning. Kate felt something very uneasy in her stomach. According to recent issues of Whistledown, Lady Bridgerton was on a mission to get her son married off, and while the Viscount didn't seem the sort of man to bend to his mother's will, or anyone's for that matter, Kate had a feeling that Lady Bridgerton would be able to exert quite a bit of pressure, if she so chose. After a few more moments of polite chatter, Mary and Kate left Lady Bridgerton to greet the rest of her guests. They were soon accosted by Mrs. Featherington, who, as the mother of three unmarried young women herself, always had a lot to say to Mary on a wide variety of topics. But as the stout woman bore down on them, her eyes were focused firmly on Kate. Kate immediately began to assess possible escape routes.
Kate!
Mrs. Featherington boomed. She had long since declared herself on a first-name basis with the Sheffields.
What a surprise to see you here!
And why is that, Mrs. Featherington?
Kate asked, puzzled.
Surely you read Whistledown this morning?
Kate smiled weakly. It was either that or wince.
Oh,
You mean that little incident involving my dog?
Mrs. Featherington's brows rose a good half inch.
From what I hear, it was more than a little incident.
It was of little consequence, Kate said firmly, although, truth be told, she was finding it difficult not to growl at the meddlesome woman.
And I must say, I resent Lady Whistledown referring to Newton as a dog of indeterminate breed. I'll have you know he is a full-blooded corgi.
It was truly of no matter, Mary said, finally coming to Kate's defence. I'm surprised it even warranted a mention in the column. Kate offered Mrs. Featherington her blandest smile, fully aware that both she and Mary were lying through their teeth. Dunking Edwina, and nearly dunking Lord Bridgerton, in the Serpentine was not an incident of little consequence, but if Lady Whistledown hadn't seen fit to report the full details, Kate certainly wasn't about to fill the gap. Mrs. Featherington opened her mouth, a sharp intake of breath, telling Kate that she was preparing to launch into a lengthy monologue on the topic of the importance of good deportment, or good manners, or good breeding, or good whatever the day's topic was. So Kate quickly blurted out,
"May I fetch you two some lemonade?"
The two matrons said yes and thanked her, and Kate slipped away. Once she returned, however, she smiled innocently and said,
"But I have only two hands, so now I must return for a glass for myself."
And with that, she took her leave. She stopped briefly at the lemonade table, just in case Mary was looking, then darted out of the room and into the hall, where she sank onto a cushioned bench about 10 yards from the music room, eager to get a bit of air. Lady Bridgerton had left the music room's French doors open to the small garden at the back of the house, but it was such a crush that the air was stifling, even with the slight breeze from outside. She remained where she sat for several minutes, more than pleased that the other guests had not chosen to spill out into the hall. But then she heard one particular voice rise slightly above the low rumble of the crowd, followed by decidedly musical laughter, and Kate realised with horror that Lord Bridgerton and his would-be mistress were leaving the music room and entering the hall.
"Oh, no,"
she groaned, trying to keep her voice to herself. The last thing she wanted was for the Viscount to stumble across her sitting alone in the hall. She knew she was by herself by choice, but he'd probably think she'd fled the gathering because she was a social failure, and all the ton shared his opinion of her, that she was an impertinent, unattractive menace to society. Menace to society? Kate's teeth clamped together. It would take a long, long time before she'd forgive him that insult. But still, she was tired, and she didn't feel like facing him just then. So she hitched up her skirts by a few inches to save her from tripping, and ducked into the doorway next to her bench. With any luck, he and his paramour would walk on by, and she could scoot back into the music room, no one being the wiser. Kate looked around quickly as she shut the door. There was a lighted lantern on a desk, and as her eyes adjusted to the dimness, she realised she was in some sort of office. The walls were lined with books, although not enough for this to be the Bridgerton's library, and the room was dominated by a massive oak desk. Papers lay on top in neat piles, and a quill and inkpot still sat on the blotter. Clearly this office was not just for show. Someone actually worked here. Kate wandered toward the desk, her curiosity getting the better of her, and idly ran her fingers along the wooden rim. The air still smelled faintly of ink, and maybe the slightest hint of pipe smoke. All in all, she decided, it was a lovely room, comfortable and practical. A person could spend hours here in lazy contemplation. But just as Kate leaned back against the desk, savouring her quiet solitude, she heard an awful sound, the click of a doorknob. With a frantic gasp, she dove under the desk, squeezing herself into the empty cube of space and thanking the heavens that the desk was completely solid, rather than the sort that rested on 4 spindly legs. Barely breathing, she listened.
But I had heard this would be the year we would finally see the notorious Lord Bridgerton fall into the parson's mousetrap, came a lilting feminine voice. Kate bit her lip. It was a lilting feminine voice with an Italian accent.
And where did you hear that?
Came the unmistakable voice of the Viscount, followed by another awful click of the doorknob. Kate shut her eyes in agony. She was trapped in the office with a pair of lovers. Life simply could not get any worse than this. Well, she could be discovered. That would be worse. Funny how that didn't make her feel much better about her present predicament, though.
It is all over town, my lord, Maria replied. Everyone is saying you have decided to settle down and choose a bride.
There was a silence, but Kate could swear she could hear him shrug. Some footsteps, most probably drawing the lovers closer together. Then Bridgerton murmured,
It is probably past time.
You are breaking my heart. Did you know that?
Kate thought she might gag.
Now, now, my sweet signorina.
The sound of lips on skin.
We both know that your heart is impervious to any of my machinations.
Next came a rustling sound, which Kate took to be Maria pulling coyly away, followed by,
But I am not inclined for a dalliance, my lord. I do not look for marriage, of course. That would be most foolish. But when I next choose a protector, it shall be for, shall we say, the long term.
Footsteps. Perhaps Bridgerton was closing the distance between them again. His voice was low and husky, as he said,
I fail to see the problem.
Your wife may see a problem.
Bridgerton chuckled.
The only reason to give up one's mistress is if one happens to love one's wife. And as I do not intend to choose a wife with whom I might fall in love, I see no reason to deny myself the pleasures of a lovely woman like you.
And do you want to marry Edwina?
It was all Kate could do not to scream. Truly, if she weren't squatting like a frog with her hands wrapped around her ankles, she probably would have emerged like a fury and tried to murder the man. Then followed a few unintelligible sounds, which Kate dearly prayed were not the prelude to something considerably more intimate. After a moment, though, the Viscount's voice emerged clearly.
Would you care for something to drink?
Maria murmured her assent, and Bridgerton's forceful stride echoed along the floor, growing closer and closer until...
Oh, no!
Kate spied the decanter, sitting on the windowsill, directly opposite her hiding spot under the desk. If he just kept his face to the window as he poured, she might escape detection. But if he turned so much as halfway... She froze, utterly froze, completely stopped breathing. Eyes wide and unblinking. Could eyelids make a sound? She watched with utter and complete horror as Bridgerton came into view. His athletic frame displayed to surprising benefit from her vantage point on the floor. The tumblers clinked slightly together as he set them down. Then he pulled the stopper from the decanter and poured two fingers of amber liquid into each glass.
Don't turn around. Don't turn around.
Is everything all right?
Maria called out.
Perfect,
Bridgerton answered, although he sounded vaguely distracted. He lifted the glasses, humming slightly to himself as his body slowly began to turn.
Keep walking, keep walking.
If he walked away from her while he turned, he'd go back to Maria and she'd be safe. But if he turned and then walked, Kate was as good as dead. And she had no doubt that he would kill her. Frankly, she was surprised he hadn't made an attempt last week at the Serpentine. Slowly, he turned, and didn't walk. And Kate tried to think of all the reasons why dying at the age of 21 was really not such a bad thing. Antony knew quite well why he'd brought Maria Rosso back to his study. Surely no warm-blooded man could be immune to her charms. Her body was lush, her voice was intoxicating, and he knew from experience that her touch was equally potent. But even as he took in that silky sable hair and those full, pouting lips, even as his muscles tightened at the memory of other full, pouting parts of her body, he knew that he was using her. He felt no guilt that he would be using her for his own pleasure. In that regard, she was using him as well, and she at least would be compensated for it, whereas he would be out several jewels, a quarterly allowance, and the rent on a fashionable townhouse in a fashionable, but not too fashionable, part of town. No, if he felt uneasy, if he felt frustrated, if he felt like he wanted to put his damned fist through a brick wall, it was because he was using Maria to banish the nightmare that was Kate Sheffield from his mind. He never wanted to wake up hard and tortured again, knowing that Kate Sheffield was the cause. He wanted to drown himself in another woman until the very memory of the dream dissolved and faded into nothingness. Because God knew he was never going to act on that particular erotic fantasy. He didn't even like Kate Sheffield. The thought of bedding her made him break out in a cold sweat, even as it swirled a ripple of desire right through his gut. No, the only way that dream was going to come true was if he were delirious with fever. And maybe she'd have to be delirious as well, and perhaps they would both have to be stranded on a desert isle, or sentenced to be executed in the morning, or... Antony shuddered. It simply wasn't going to happen. But bloody hell, the woman must have bewitched him. There could be no other explanation for the dream. No, make that a nightmare. And besides that, even now he could swear that he could smell her. It was that maddening combination of lilies and soap, that beguiling scent that had washed over him while they were out in Hyde Park last week. Here he was, pouring a glass of the finest whiskey for Maria Rosso, one of the few women of his acquaintance who knew how to appreciate both a fine whiskey and the devilish intoxication that followed, and all he could smell was the damned scent of Kate Sheffield. He knew she was in the house, and he was half ready to kill his mother for that, but this was ridiculous.
"Is everything all right?" Maria called out.
"Perfect," Antony said, his voice sounding tight to his ears. He began to hum, something he'd always done to relax himself. He turned and started to take a step forward. Maria was waiting for him after all. But there was that damned scent again. Lilies. He could swear it was lilies. And soap. The lilies were intriguing, but the soap made sense. A practical sort of woman, like Kate Sheffield, would scrub herself clean with soap. His foot hesitated in mid-air, and his step forward proved to be a small one instead of his usual long stride. He couldn't quite escape the smell, and he kept turning, his nose instinctively twisting his eyes toward where he knew there couldn't be lilies, and yet the scent was, impossibly, there. And then he saw her. Under his desk. It was impossible. Surely this was a nightmare. Surely if he closed his eyes and opened them again, she'd be gone. He blinked. She was still there. Kate Sheffield, the most maddening, irritating, diabolical woman in all England, was crouching like a frog under his desk. It was a wonder he didn't drop the whiskey. Their eyes met, and he saw hers widen with panic and fright. Good, he thought savagely. She should be frightened. He was going to tan her bloody hide until her hide was bloody well bloody. What the hell was she doing here? Wasn't dousing him with the filthy water of the Serpentine enough for her bloodthirsty spirit? Wasn't she satisfied with her attempts to stymie his courtship of her sister? Did she need to spy on him as well?
Maria, he said smoothly, moving forward toward the desk, until he was stepping on Kate's hand. He didn't step hard, but he heard her squeak. This gave him immense satisfaction.
Maria, he repeated, I have suddenly remembered an urgent matter of business that must be dealt with immediately.
This very night? She asked, sounding quite dubious.
I'm afraid so.
Ugh!
Maria blinked.
Did you just grunt?
No, Antony lied, trying not to choke on the word.
Kate had removed her glove and wrapped her hand around his knee, digging her nails straight through his breeches and into his skin. Hard. At least he hoped it was her nails. It could have been her teeth.
Are you sure there's nothing amiss? Maria inquired.
Nothing at...
Whatever body part Kate was sinking into his leg sank a little farther.
All!
The last word came out as more of a howl, and he kicked his foot forward, connecting with something he had a sneaking suspicion was her stomach. Normally, Antony would die before striking a woman, but this truly seemed to be an exceptional case. In fact, he took not a little bit of pleasure in kicking her while she was down. She was biting his leg, after all.
"Allow me to walk you to the door,"
he said to Maria, shaking Kate off his ankle. But Maria's eyes were curious, and she took a few steps forward.
"Antony, is there an animal under your desk?"
Antony let out a bark of laughter.
"You could say that."
Kate's fist came down on his foot.
"Is it a dog?"
Antony seriously considered answering in the affirmative, but even he was not that cruel. Kate obviously appreciated his uncharacteristic tact, because she let go of his leg. Antony took advantage of his release to quickly step out from behind the desk.
"Would I be unforgivably rude,"
he asked, striding to Maria's side and taking her arm, "if I merely walked you to the door and not back to the music room?" She laughed, a low, sultry sound that should have seduced him.
"I am a grown woman, my lord. I believe I can manage the short distance."
"Forgive me."
She stepped through the door he held open for her.
"I suspect there isn't a woman alive who could deny you forgiveness for that smile."
"You are a rare woman, Maria Rosso."
She laughed again.
"But not, apparently, rare enough."
She floated out, and Antony shut the door with a decisive click. Then, some devil on his shoulder surely prodding him, he turned the key in the lock and pocketed it.
"You!"
he boomed, eliminating the distance to the desk in four long strides.
"Show yourself!"
When Kate didn't scramble out quickly enough, he reached down, clamped his hand around her upper arm, and hauled her to her feet.
"Explain yourself!" he hissed.
Kate's legs nearly buckled as the blood rushed back to her knees, which had been bent for nearly a quarter of an hour.
"It was an accident,"
she said, grabbing onto the edge of the desk for support.
"Funny how those words seem to emerge from your mouth with startling frequency."
"It's true,"
she protested.
"I was sitting in the hall and..."
She gulped. He had stepped forward and was now very, very close.
"I was sitting in the hall,"
she said again, her voice sounding crackly and hoarse,
"and I heard you coming. I was just trying to avoid you."
"And so you invaded my private office?"
"I didn't know it was your office. I..."
Kate sucked in her breath. He'd moved even closer, his crisp, wide lapels now only inches from the bodice of her dress. She knew his proximity was deliberate, that he sought to intimidate rather than seduce, but that didn't do anything to quell the frantic beating of her heart.
"I think perhaps you did know that this was my office,"
he murmured, letting his forefinger trail down the side of her cheek.
"Perhaps you did not seek to avoid me at all."
Kate swallowed convulsively, long past the point of trying to maintain her composure.
"Hmm?"
His finger slid along the line of her jaw.
"What do you say to that?"
Kate's lips parted, but she couldn't have uttered a word if her life had depended on it. He wore no gloves. He must have removed them during his tryst with Maria, and the touch of his skin against hers was so powerful it seemed to control her body.
She breathed when he paused, stopped when he moved. She had no doubt that her heart was beating in time to his pulse.
Maybe,
he whispered, so close now that his breath kissed her lips.
You desired something else altogether.
Kate tried to shake her head, but her muscles refused to obey.
Are you sure?
This time, her head betrayed her, and gave a little shake. He smiled, and they both knew he had won.
Chapter 7. Also in attendance at Lady Bridgerton's musicale, Mrs. Featherington and the three elder Featherington daughters, Prudence, Philippa, and Penelope, none of whom wore colours beneficial to their complexions, Mr. Nigel Burbrook, who, as usual, had much to say, although no one save Philippa Featherington seemed interested, and, of course, Mrs. Sheffield and Miss Catherine Sheffield. This author assumes that the Sheffields' invitation had also included Miss Edwina Sheffield, but she was not present. Lord Bridgerton seemed in fine spirits, despite the younger Miss Sheffield's absence, but alas, his mother appeared disappointed. But then again, Lady Bridgerton's matchmaking tendencies are legendary, and surely she must be at loose ends, now that her daughter has married the Duke of Hastings. Lady Whistledown's Society Papers, 27th of April, 1814. Antony knew he had to be insane. There could be no other explanation. He'd meant to scare her, terrify her, make her understand that she could never hope to meddle in his affairs and win. And instead, he kissed her. Intimidation had been his intention, and so he'd moved closer and closer, until she, an innocent, could only be cowed by his presence. She wouldn't know what it was like to have a man so near that the heat of his body seeped through her clothes, so close that she couldn't tell where his breath ended and hers began. She wouldn't recognize the first prickles of desire, nor would she understand that slow, swirling heat in the core of her being. And that slow, swirling heat was there. He could see it in her face. But she, a complete innocent, would never comprehend what he could see with one look of his experienced eyes. All she would know was that he was looming over her, that he was stronger, more powerful, and that she had made a dreadful mistake by invading his private sanctuary. He was going to stop right there and leave her bothered and breathless. But when there was barely an inch between them, the pull grew too strong. Her scent was too beguiling, the sound of her breath too arousing. The prickles of desire he'd meant to spark within her suddenly ignited within him, sending a warm claw of need to the very tips of his toes. And the finger he'd been trailing along her cheek, just to torture her, he told himself, suddenly became a hand that cupped the back of her head as his lips took hers in an explosion of anger and desire. She gasped against his mouth, and he took advantage of her parted lips by sliding his tongue between them. She was stiff in his arms, but it seemed more to do with surprise than anything else, and so Antony pressed his suit further by allowing one of his hands to slide down her back and cup the gentle curve of her derriere.
"This is madness,"
he whispered against her ear, but he made no move to let her go. Her reply was an incoherent, confused moan, and her body became slightly more pliant in his arms, allowing him to mould her even closer to his form. He knew he should stop, knew he damned well shouldn't have started, but his blood was racing with need, and she felt so good. He groaned, his lips leaving hers to taste the slightly salty skin of her neck. There was something about her that suited him like no woman ever had before, as if his body had discovered something his mind utterly refused to consider. Something about her was right. She felt right. She smelled right. She tasted right. and he knew that if he stripped off all of her clothes and took her there on the carpet of the floor of his study, she would fit underneath him, fit around him, just right. It occurred to Anthony that when she wasn't arguing with him, Kate Sheffield might bloody well be the finest woman in England. Her arms, which had been imprisoned in his embrace, slowly edged up until her hands were hesitantly resting on his back, and then her lips moved. It was a tiny thing, actually, a movement barely felt on the thin skin of his forehead, but she was definitely kissing him back. A low, triumphant growl emerged from Antony's mouth as he moved his mouth back to hers, kissing her fiercely, daring her to continue what she'd begun. "Oh, Kate," he moaned, nudging her back until she was leaning against the edge of the desk. "God, you taste so good." "Bridgerton." Her voice was tremulous, the word more of a question than anything else. "Don't say anything," he whispered. "Whatever you do, don't say anything." "But not a word," he interrupted, pressing a finger to her lips. The last thing he wanted was for her to ruin this perfectly good moment by opening her mouth and arguing. "But I..." She planted her hands on his chest and wrenched herself away, leaving him off balance and panting. Antony let out a curse, and not a mild one. Kate scurried away, not all the way across the room, but over to a tall wing-back chair, far enough away so that she was not in arm's reach. She gripped the stiff back of the chair, then darted around it, thinking that it might be a good idea to have a nice, solid piece of furniture between them. The Viscount didn't look to be in the best of tempers.
"Why did you do that?"
she said, her voice so low it was almost a whisper. He shrugged, suddenly looking a little less angry and a little more uncaring.
"Because I wanted to."
Kate just gaped at him for a moment, unable to believe that he could have such a simple answer to what was, despite its simple phrasing, such a complicated question. Finally she blurted out,
"But you can't have..."
He smiled, slowly.
"But I did."
"But you don't like me."
"True," he allowed.
"And I don't like you."
"So you've been telling me," he said smoothly. "I'll have to take your word for it, since it wasn't particularly apparent a few seconds ago."
Kate felt her cheeks flush with shame. She had responded to his wicked kiss, and she hated herself for it, almost as much as she hated him for initiating the intimacy. But he didn't have to taunt her. That was the act of a cad. She gripped the back of the chair until her knuckles turned white, no longer certain if she was using it as a defence against Bridgerton or as a means to stop herself from lunging forward to strangle him.
"I am not going to let you marry Edwina," she said in a very low voice.
"No," he murmured, moving slowly forward until he was just on the other side of the chair. "I didn't think you were."
Her chin lifted a notch.
"And I am certainly not going to marry you."
He planted his hands on the armrests and leaned forward until his face was only a few inches from hers.
"I don't recall asking."
Kate lurched backward.
"But you just kissed me."
He laughed.
"If I offered marriage to every woman I'd kissed, I'd have been thrown into jail for bigamy long ago."
Kate could feel herself begin to shake, and she held on to the back of the chair for dear life.
"You, sir,"
she nearly spat out,
"have no honour."
His eyes blazed, and one of his hands shot out to grip her chin. He held her that way for several seconds, forcing her to meet his gaze.
"That," he said in a deadly voice, "is not true. And were you a man, I'd call you out for it."
Kate remained still for what seemed like a very long time, her eyes locked on his, the skin on her cheek burning where his powerful fingers held her motionless. Finally, she did the one thing she'd sworn she would never do with this man. She begged.
"Please,"
she whispered.
Let me go.
He did, his hand releasing her with a startling abruptness. My apologies, he said, sounding the slightest bit surprised. No, that was impossible. Nothing could surprise this man. I didn't mean to hurt you, he added softly.
Didn't you?
He gave his head a small shake. No, to scare you, perhaps, but not to hurt you. Kate stepped backward on shaky legs.
You're nothing but a rake,
she said, wishing her voice had emerged with a bit more disdain and a bit less quavering. I know, he said with a shrug, the intense fire in his eyes draining down to light amusement. It's in my nature. Kate took another step back. She didn't have the energy to try to keep up with his abrupt changes of mood.
I'm leaving now.
Go, he said affably, waving toward the door.
You can't stop me.
He smiled. I wouldn't dream of it. She began to edge away, walking slowly backward, afraid that if she took her eyes off him for one second, he might pounce.
I'm leaving now,
she said again, unnecessarily. But when her hand was an inch away from the doorknob, he said, I suppose I'll see you next time I call upon Edwina. Kate went white. Not that she could actually see her face, of course, but for the first time in her life, she actually felt the blood drain from her skin.
You said you were going to leave her alone, she said accusingly.
No, he replied, leaning rather insolently against the side of the chair. I said that I didn't think you were likely to let me marry her, which doesn't really signify, as I have no plans to let you manage my life. Kate suddenly felt as if a cannonball were lodged in her throat.
But you can't possibly want to marry her after you... After I...
He took a few steps toward her, his movements slow and sleek like a cat. After you kissed me.
I didn't.
But the words burned the back of her throat, because they were so obviously a lie. She had not initiated the kiss, but she had, in the end, participated in it. Oh, come now, Miss Sheffield, he said, standing up straight and crossing his arms. Let's not go down that road. We don't like each other. That much is true. But I do respect you in an odd, perverted sort of way. And I know you're not a liar. She said nothing. Really, what could she say? How did one respond to a statement that contained the words respect and perverted? You kissed me back, he said, with a small, satisfied smile. Not with any great enthusiasm, I'll admit, but that would be just a matter of time. She shook her head, unable to believe what she was hearing.
How can you talk of such things, not even a minute after declaring your intention to court my sister?
This does put a bit of a crimp in my plans, that is true, he commented, his voice light and thoughtful, as if he were considering the purchase of a new horse, or perhaps deciding which neckcloth to wear. Maybe it was his casual posture. Maybe it was the way he stroked his chin, as if pretending to give the matter some thought. But something ignited a fuse inside of Kate, and without even thinking, she launched forward, all the furies of the world collecting in her soul as she threw herself against him, pounding his chest with her fists.
You will never marry her,
she cried out.
Never! Do you hear me?
He raised one arm to ward off a blow to his face. I'd have to be deaf not to. Then he expertly captured her wrists, holding her arms immobile while her body heaved and shook with rage.
I won't let you make her unhappy. I won't let you ruin her life,
she said, the words choking in her throat.
She is everything that is good and honourable and pure, and she deserves better than you.
Antony watched her closely, his eyes trained on her face, somehow rendered beautiful by the force of her anger. Her cheeks were high with colour. Her eyes shone with tears she was fighting hard to keep off her face, and he was beginning to feel like he might be the worst sort of cad.
"Why, Miss Sheffield," he said softly, "I do believe you truly love your sister."
"Of course I love her," she burst out. "Why do you think I have gone to such efforts to keep her away from you? Did you think I did it for amusement? Because I can assure you, my lord, I can think of many things more amusing than being held captive in your study."
Abruptly, he let go of her wrists.
"I should think,"
she said with a sniffle, rubbing her reddened, abused flesh,
"that my love for Edwina would be the one thing about me you could understand with perfect clarity. You, who were supposedly so devoted to your own family."
Antony said nothing, just watched her, and wondered if perhaps there was a great deal more to this woman than he'd originally estimated.
"If you were Edwina's brother,"
Kate said with deadly accuracy,
"would you allow her to marry a man like you?"
He did not speak for a very long moment, long enough so that the silence rang awkwardly in his own ears. Finally, he said,
"That is beside the point."
To her credit, she did not smile. She did not crow, nor did she taunt. When she spoke, her words were quiet and true.
"I believe I have my answer."
Then she turned on her heel and began to walk away.
"My sister,"
he said, loudly enough to halt her progress toward the door,
"married the Duke of Hastings. Are you familiar with his reputation?"
She paused, but she did not turn around.
"He is reputed to be quite devoted to his wife."
Antony chuckled.
"Then you are not familiar with his reputation, at least not as it was before he married."
Kate turned slowly around.
"If you are attempting to convince me that reformed rakes make the best husbands, you will meet with no success. It was in this very room, not 15 minutes ago, that you told Miss Rosso that you saw no reason to give up a mistress for a wife."
"I believe I said that was the case only if one does not love one's wife."
A funny little sound emerged from her nose. Not quite a snort, but more than a breath, and it was abundantly clear, in that moment at least, that she had no respect for him. With a sharp amusement in her eyes, she asked,
"And do you love my sister, Lord Bridgerton?"
"Of course not," he replied, "and I would never insult your intelligence by saying otherwise. But,"
he said loudly, warding off the interruption he knew was sure to come,
"I have known your sister but a week. I have no reason to believe that I would not come to love her, were we to spend many years in holy matrimony."
She crossed her arms.
"Why is it that I cannot believe a word out of your mouth?"
He shrugged.
"I'm sure I do not know."
But he did know. The very reason he'd selected Edwina for his wife was that he knew he'd never come to love her. He liked her. He respected her, and he was confident that she'd make an excellent mother to his heirs. But he'd never love her. The spark simply was not there. She shook her head, disappointment in her eyes, disappointment that somehow made him feel less of a man.
"I hadn't thought you a liar either,"
she said softly. "A rake and a rogue, and perhaps a whole host of other things, but not a liar." Antony felt her words like blows. Something unpleasant squeezed around his heart, something that made him want to lash out, to hurt her, or at least to show her she hadn't the power to hurt him.
"Oh, Miss Sheffield,"
he called out, his voice a rather cruel drawl,
"you won't get far without this."
Before she had a chance to react, he reached into his pocket, pulled out the key to the study, and tossed it in her direction, deliberately aiming it at her feet. Given no warning, her reflexes were not sharp, and when she thrust out her hands to catch the key, she missed it entirely. Her hands made a hollow clapping sound as they connected, followed by the dull thud of the key hitting the carpet. She stood there for a moment, staring at the key, and he could tell the instant she realized he had not intended for her to catch it. She remained utterly still, and then she brought her eyes to his. They were blazing with hatred, and something worse, disdain. Antony felt as if he'd been punched in the gut. He fought the most ridiculous impulse to leap forward and grab the key from the carpet, to get down on one knee and hand it to her, to apologize for his conduct and beg her forgiveness. But he would do none of those things. He did not want to mend this breach. He did not want her favorable opinion. Because that elusive spark, the one so noticeably absent with her sister, whom he intended to marry, crackled and burned so strongly, it seemed the room ought to be as light as day. And nothing could have terrified him more. Kate remained motionless for far longer than he would have thought, obviously loath to kneel before him, even if it was to gather up the key that would provide her with the escape she so obviously desired. Antony just forced a smile, lowering his gaze to the floor and then back up to her face.
"Don't you want to leave, Miss Sheffield?" he said, too smoothly.
He watched as her chin trembled, as her throat worked a convulsive swallow, and then, abruptly, she crouched down and scooped up the key.
"You will never marry my sister," she vowed, her low, intense voice sending chills to his very bones. "Never."
And then, with a decisive click of the lock, she was gone. 2 days later, Kate was still furious. It didn't help that the afternoon following the musicale, a large bouquet of flowers had arrived for Edwina, the card reading, "With my wishes for a speedy recovery. Last night was dull indeed without your shining presence. Bridgerton." Mary had oohed and aahed over the note. "So poetic," she'd sighed. "So lovely. So obviously the words of a man truly smitten." But Kate had known the truth. The note was more of an insult toward her than it was a compliment toward Edwina. "Dull indeed," she fumed, eyeing that note, enshrined now on a table in the sitting room, and wondering how she might make it look an accident if it somehow found itself torn into pieces. She might not know very much about matters of the heart and the affairs of men and women, but she'd bet her life that whatever the Viscount had been feeling that night in the study, it had not been boredom. He hadn't, however, come to call. Kate couldn't imagine why, since taking Edwina out for a drive would be an even bigger slap in the face than the note had been. In her most fanciful moments, she liked to flatter herself that he hadn't stopped by because he was afraid to face her. But she knew that was patently untrue. That man wasn't afraid of anyone, least of all a plain, aging spinster he'd probably kissed out of a mix of curiosity, anger, and pity. Kate crossed over to a window and gazed out over Milner Street. Not the most picturesque view in London, but at least it stopped her from staring at the note. It was the pity that truly ate at her. She prayed that whatever had gone into that kiss, the curiosity and the anger had outweighed the pity. She didn't think she could bear it if he pitied her. But Kate didn't have very long to obsess over the kiss and what it might and might not have meant, because that afternoon, the afternoon after the flowers, arrived an invitation far more unsettling than anything Lord Bridgerton might have issued himself. The Sheffield's presence, it seemed, was desired at a country house party, being rather spontaneously hosted in 1 week's time by Lady Bridgerton, the mother of the devil himself. And there was no way that Kate could possibly get out of going. Nothing short of an earthquake combined with a hurricane, combined with a tornado, none of which were likely to occur in Great Britain, although Kate was still holding out hope for the hurricane, as long as there was no thunder or lightning involved, would prevent Mary from showing up on the Bridgertons' bucolic doorstep with Edwina in tow. And Mary certainly wasn't going to allow Kate to remain alone in London, left to her own devices. not to mention that there was no way Kate was going to allow Edwina to go without her. The Viscount had no scruples. He'd probably kiss Edwina just as he'd kissed Kate, and Kate couldn't imagine that Edwina would have the fortitude to resist such an advance. She'd probably think it beyond romantic and fall in love with him on the spot. Even Kate had had difficulty keeping her head when his lips had been on hers. For one blissful moment, she'd forgotten everything. She'd known nothing but an exquisite sensation of being cherished and wanted. No, needed. And it had been heady stuff indeed. Almost enough to make a lady forget that the man doing the kissing was a worthless cad. Almost, but not quite. Chapter 8. As any regular reader of this column knows, there are two sects in London who shall forever remain in the utmost opposition: ambitious mamas and determined bachelors. The ambitious mamma has daughters of marriageable age. The determined bachelor does not want a wife. The crux of the conflict should be obvious to those with half a brain, or in other words, approximately 50% of this author's readership. This author has not yet seen a guest list for Lady Bridgerton's country house party, but informed sources indicate that nearly every eligible young lady of marriageable age will be gathering in Kent next week. This surprises no one. Lady Bridgerton has never made a secret of her desire to see her sons favourably married. This sentiment has made her a favourite among the ambitious mamma set, who despairingly view the Bridgerton brothers as the worst sort of determined bachelors. If one is to trust the betting books, then at least one of the Bridgerton brothers shall be witness to wedding bells before the year is through. As much as it pains this author to agree with the betting books, they are written by men and thus inherently flawed. This author must concur in the prediction. Lady Bridgerton will soon have her daughter-in-law, but who she will be, and to which brother she shall find herself married, ah, gentle reader, that is still anyone's guess. Lady Whistledown's Society Papers, 29th of April, 1814. 1 week later, Antony was in Kent, in his private suite of offices, to be precise, awaiting the start of his mother's country house party. He'd seen the guest list. There could be no doubt that his mother had decided to host this party for one reason and one reason only: to get one of her sons married off, preferably him. Aubrey Hall, the ancestral seat of the Bridgertons, would be filled to the brim with eligible young ladies, each lovelier and more empty-headed than the last. To keep numbers even, Lady Bridgerton had had to invite a number of gentlemen, to be sure, but none were as wealthy or well-connected as her own sons, save for the few who were married. His mother, Antony thought ruefully, had never been known for her subtlety, at least not when the well-being, her definition of well-being, that is, of her children was concerned. He had not been surprised to see that an invitation had been extended to the Mrs. Sheffield. His mother had mentioned several times how much he liked Mrs. Sheffield, and he had been forced to listen to his mother's "good parents make good children" theory too many times not to know what that meant. He'd actually felt a resigned sort of satisfaction upon the sight of Edwina's name on the list. He was eager to propose to her and be done with it. He did feel a measure of uneasiness over what had happened with Kate, but there seemed little to be done now, unless he wanted to go to the trouble of finding another prospective bride, which he did not. Once Antony made a decision, in this case to finally get married, he saw no reason in courting delays. Procrastination was for those with a bit more time to live out their lives. Antony might have avoided the parson's mousetrap for nearly a decade, but now that he'd decided it was time for a bride, there seemed little sense in tarrying. Marry, procreate, and die. Such was the life of a noble Englishman, even one whose father and uncle had not dropped unexpectedly dead at the ages of 38 and 34, respectively. Clearly, all he could do at this point was to avoid Kate Sheffield. An apology would probably also be in order. It wouldn't be easy, since the last thing he wanted to do was humble himself to that woman. But the whispers of his conscience had risen to a dull roar, and he knew she deserved the words, "I'm sorry." She probably deserved more, but Antony was unwilling to contemplate what that might be. Not to mention that unless he went and spoke to her, she was likely to block a union between him and Edwina to her dying breath. Now was clearly the time to take action. If there ever was a romantic spot for a proposal of marriage, Aubrey Hall was it. Built in the early 1700s of warm yellow stone, it sat comfortably on a wide green lawn, surrounded by 60 acres of parkland, a full 10 of which were flowering gardens. Later in the summer, the roses would be out, but now the grounds were carpeted with grape hyacinths and the brilliant tulips his mother had had imported from Holland. Antony gazed across the room and out the window, where ancient elms rose majestically around the house. They shaded the drive, and, he liked to think, made the hall seem a bit more like it was a part of nature, and a bit less like the typical country homes of the aristocracy, man-made monuments to wealth, position, and power. There were several ponds, a creek, and countless hills and hollows, each one with its own special memories of childhood. And his father. Antony closed his eyes and exhaled. He loved coming home to Aubrey Hall, but the familiar sights and smells brought his father to mind with a clarity so vivid it was almost painful. Even now, nearly 12 years after Edmund Bridgerton's death, Antony still expected to see him come bounding around the corner, the smallest of the Bridgerton children screaming with delight as he rode on his father's shoulders. The image made Antony grin. The child on the shoulders might be a boy or a girl. Edmund had never discriminated between his children when it came to horseplay, but no matter who held the coveted spot at the top of the world, they would surely be chased after by a nurse, insisting that they stop this nonsense at once, and that a child's place was in the nursery, and certainly not on her father's shoulders. "Oh, father," Antony whispered, looking up at the portrait of Edmund that hung over the fireplace. "How on earth will I ever live up to your achievements?" And surely that had to have been Edmund Bridgerton's greatest achievement, presiding over a family filled with love and laughter and everything that was so often absent from aristocratic life. Antony turned away from his father's portrait and crossed over to the window, watching the coaches pull up the drive. The afternoon had brought a steady stream of arrivals, and every conveyance seemed to carry yet another fresh-faced young lady, her eyes alight with happiness at having been gifted with an invitation to the Bridgerton house party. Lady Bridgerton didn't often elect to fill her country home with guests. When she did, it was always the event of the season. Although, truth be told, none of the Bridgertons spent much time at Aubrey Hall any longer. Antony suspected that his mother suffered the same malady he did, memories of Edmund around every corner. The younger children had few memories of the place, having been raised primarily in London. They certainly didn't recall the long hikes across fields, or the fishing, or the tree house. Hyacinth, who was now just 11, had never even been held in her father's arms. Antony had tried to fill the gap as best as he could, but he knew he was a very pale comparison. With a weary sigh, Antony leaned heavily against the window frame, trying to decide whether or not he wanted to pour himself a drink. He was staring out over the lawn, his eyes focusing on absolutely nothing, when a carriage, decidedly shabbier than the rest, rolled down the drive. Not that there was anything shoddy about it. It was obviously well made and sturdy, but it lacked the gilded crests that graced the other carriages, and it seemed to bump along a tiny bit more than the rest, as if it weren't quite well sprung enough for comfort. This would be the Sheffields, Antony realised. Everyone else on the guest list was in possession of a respectable fortune. Only the Sheffields would have had to hire a carriage for the season. Sure enough, when one of the Bridgerton footmen, dressed in stylish powder-blue livery, leaped forward to open the door, out stepped Edwina Sheffield, looking a veritable vision in a pale yellow travelling dress and matching bonnet. Antony was not close enough to see her face clearly, but it was easy enough to imagine. Her cheeks would be soft and pink, and her exquisite eyes would mirror the cloudless sky. The next to emerge was Mrs. Sheffield. It was only when she took her place next to Edwina that he realised how closely they resembled one another. Both were charmingly graceful and petite, and as they spoke, he could see that they held themselves in the same manner. The tilt of the head was identical, as were their posture and stance. Edwina would not outgrow her beauty. This would clearly be a good attribute in a wife, although, Antony threw a rueful glance at his father's portrait, he wasn't likely to be around to watch her age. Finally, Kate stepped down, and Antony realised he'd been holding his breath. She didn't move like the two other Sheffield women. They had been dainty, leaning on the footman, putting their hands in his with a graceful arch of the wrist. Kate, on the other hand, practically hopped right down. She took the footman's proffered arm, but she certainly didn't appear to need his assistance. As soon as her feet touched the ground, she stood tall and lifted her face to gaze at the facade of Aubrey Hall. Everything about her was direct and straightforward, and Antony had no doubt that if he were close enough to gaze into her eyes, he would find them utterly forthright. Once she saw him, however, they would fill with disdain, and perhaps a touch of hatred as well, which was really all he deserved. A gentleman did not treat a lady as he had Kate Sheffield and expect her continued good favour. Kate turned to her mother and sister and said something, causing Edwina to laugh and Mary to smile indulgently. Antony realised he hadn't had much opportunity to watch the three of them interact before. They were a true family, comfortable in each other's presence, and there was a warmth one sensed in their faces when they conversed. It was especially fascinating, since he knew